Favorite gymnast growing up?
Gina Collins, one. She's my cousin. I would say Mary Lou Retton, actually, is who was favorite for me back then.
Favorite gymnasts now?
A little after Mary Lou Retton, it was Dominique Dawes, even though she's a little younger than me. So I'll still say Dominique Dawes. And all of the collegiate girls are amazing. So I'll group all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All the brown girls, all the brown college girls. I'll say that.
Yeah. 80s music or 90s music?
Wow. That's hard. I can't choose. I can't. 80s and 90s, both. I can't choose.
I'm Pam Majumdar.
I'm Danielle Gray, founder of Train Like a Gymnast.
And you're listening to Better Late.
So Darren, you founded Brown Girls Do Gymnastics, which is an incredible movement. Tell me about your background in gymnastics and sports that led you to creating Brown Girls Do Gymnastics.
There's so much in my background, I guess, when it comes to sports. My family's just a big athletic family. Baseball is the big sport in my family. So my very first sport was softball, which is why that came up. And then gymnastics was after. Gymnastics, the first time I walked in a gym, I can remember that day vividly. I was 5 years old and like the blue mats and the swinging and all the stuff. The bars were right in the front. So it was like, oh my gosh. And I was a crazy kid, jumping on everything. And so gymnastics like got in my soul real early, you know? And throughout my, I'd say career, I guess, I always wanted to coach. Even the girls who were on my team or in my classes, I would spot them. And I mean, they like maybe even bigger than me and I'm like spotting kids. I told my mom really early that I wanted to own a gym. And it was just kind of something that always stuck in my head. I didn't go to school for that at all. I went to school for biochemistry. And now I flip kids around. So for Brown Girls, I think that there's a combination of like me as a little one. I said that Mary Lou Retton was my favorite back then. I had her leotard and her signature on it. And I mean, not, it was the way they made the leotard. It wasn't really her signature, but I didn't know of any other black or brown gymnast outside of like my cousin or people that I kind of saw in the gym, but there weren't many. There was a coach, Gayla, but just not many folks and that I knew. And so like when I heard about the Diane Durham story, it was kind of heartbreaking because again, Mary Lou Retton was my favorite, but I didn't know about Diane Durham. And she actually was like top over Mary Lou Retton until all of the craziness happened. So I think like the combination of all of those things and then I had already started my gym, which is In Flight, and things that I came across with In Flight, being at competitions, and well, even the gym itself, like I didn't set out for it to be an all black gym. I mean, I knew that I was black and I was in an underserved community, but I grew up around everybody. And so if people came to the gym, if they saw us on website, we're in Decatur, and if people came in and saw that we were all black, they wouldn't come back, you know? So we ended up just being an all black program, going to meets and the eyes that would look at us or the judges who would ask us every meet, where are you guys from? You just asked me that. Like you just asked me that, you know? I had a judge tell me, so I won't make this story super long. We were on vault, my kids on vault the year before. I know I had two vault champs at state that year, maybe more, but that level for sure. There were two girls who won state, their age group, and they're vaulting and the vaults look really good from where I am. And the scores are like sevens and sixes. And so I'm like, what's happening, you know? And I mean, of course you can't, like I was at the end of the runway with the kids, so I couldn't necessarily see exactly where they're coming off, but didn't look like sixes and sevens. And so after the rotation, it was a kind of small meet and I felt comfortable enough to go talk to the judge without like doing a for real inquiry. And went talk to the judge and was like, she was like, oh, you're coming to check their scores. And I was like, yeah, you know, and she was like, do they usually score better? And I was like, yeah, I got two state champs right there. And this was the same vault. You know how like compulsory is they keep the same vault forever. And she was like, well, you know, they're coming off the vault here and da da da. And I was like, but these kids are really good at vault. I mean, they're good, but they're like good at vault for real. And she patted me on my hand. My hand was on the table. She patted me on my hand and she was like, it's okay. You're doing a really good job keeping these kids off the street. I laugh now. At the time, I did not laugh. And I literally had to, like, you know, they say bite your tongue. Like, it was like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
I knew.
Did
yeah.
you have fun? Did you say?
I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
You know?
Was that like a pivotal moment for you that took you from just an entrepreneur as like a gym owner to going the more philanthropic route with your mission?
I think I've always had that philanthropic route. Like, I always wanted the parents to fundraise to make the money because they were kids who couldn't afford. And I didn't want that, like, you know, that differentiation between all of them. But it definitely took me a different direction, or took me further in that direction. So my kids were I had one little girl that I think about all the time when it comes to this specific thing. Her mom used to work for PricewaterhouseCoopers. Like, she was like a, you know, exec with them. Her dad was a tenured professor at Georgia Tech, used to be a professor at Stanford. These are like, you know, pretty affluent folks. But then I also had kids who couldn't afford it. But keeping them off the streets, like, their parents are right there. And you know what I mean? It was kind of like, so I went to, there was a parent who helps me a lot. And I said, I'm going to tell you something, but you cannot say anything to the parents, because I knew that they would like go off. And I told her, and she was like, what, Coach Darren? I was like, calm down. You know, I was like, she probably didn't even, I mean, regardless, it was wrong, you know, but this was an older white lady in rural Georgia. She thought she was being nice, you know, and it did get out to the parents and it was a whole mess, but it definitely made me like not shy away from the blackness. I couldn't shy away from it. And in a certain sense, I had dreadlocks down, or I shouldn't say dreadlocks, locks down in my butt. I've always been like very much who I am, but I didn't necessarily want the kids to be outwardly different, you know, outside of them being black. And so that made it different for me. The next recital that we did a recital at the end of each year, because that's how I grew up. And that next recital, the girls wore HBCU leotards as their recital. So as their like recital Leos. So we had a FAMU team and a Southern team and a Howard team. And there was one that I'm missing, I think. I know those three for sure. I know I'm missing one. But just to bring to light that, like, hey, yeah, we're different. When we go to these meets, people are looking at us and that's fine. But look what else we've done. That's amazing. You know, where'd your parents go to school? Where'd your grandparents go to school? And that's like super huge. And let's like celebrate that. So yeah, it was definitely Danielle pivotal in a way, you know, and that I think all of those instances, I guess, brought me to take on the extra work of Brown Girls, because I wasn't going to at first. I was like, I'm doing enough. And then I was like, you know what? Let's go.
You talked a bit about kind of learning about Diane Durham later.
I learned about Diane Durham when I was coaching. I was in my 20s, so it's been a long time now. I was coaching in College Park, which was another gym that was predominantly Black and Brown, not all. There was a city-run program, and the head of the programs in this rec center were white, all white. Well, maybe one or two Black folks, but mostly white people. And the gymnastics coordinator was white. And we would see, they would like, we'd get these t-shirts and then have a white gymnast on it. But literally like 90% of the kids were Black, you know? And so I started looking for pictures of Black gymnasts, and like in the magazine that's Inside, I think, that's been around for a really long time. Technique, maybe, I don't know. Any the gymnastics magazines that have been around for a while, and like just ripping pictures out and putting them on the bulletin board in the gym. And that's when I discovered Diane Durham, just like looking for Black gymnasts. And that I felt like was way too late, you know, especially for, like, I'm telling you, Mary Lou Retton, like, I was going to be like her in my head, you know what I mean? And to know, to find out later that Diane Durham was actually like ranked higher than her, it's kind of sad. I had been coaching already for 8 years, maybe before 6 years, maybe before this all happened. So it's definitely late. I do feel like having, I mean, they, you know what they say, representation matters. It literally does matter. Being able to see, you know, I think there are those folks who are just trailblazers, or they're that talented that someone else pushes them along. You know what I mean? Like Diane Durham and Corrine Tarver, who's the head at Fisk now. These folks are like, you can't deny their talent, you know? I'm athletic, but I wasn't necessarily like some gymnastics prodigy, you know? And so I feel like if I had had more people around me who made it real, I definitely would have stuck with it a little longer. I was done at 14. It wasn't as important anymore, you know, cheerleading was and hanging out, and, you know what I mean? But I think, which is one of the reasons why I pushed so hard for HBCU gymnastics, because I knew at 14 that I was going to an HBCU. So, you know, I didn't see gymnastics anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, even though you stopped at 14, like you said, gymnastics got into your soul. And I think that,
oh, yeah.
The way you phrase that, I mean, I think that's true for so many people who love gymnastics and just can't get away from it. It kind of becomes almost like a relationship that you can't let go, can't let go of. And now, I mean, now your path in gymnastics is not as an athlete, but still so impactful. And you said you have your own gym, and then Brown Girls Do Gymnastics started as a brand on Instagram, right? Is that where it first started? Now, as both have evolved, you as a coach and gym owner and the founder of this brand, I'm curious, like, how does that play with, like, are your athletes that you coach, are they all involved with Brown Girls Do Gymnastics? How do the two brands kind of interact?
So the very first conference, I say we had 24 kids because there are 24 kids that were not my kids. There are 24 who came from all over the place, but including my kids, we probably have 50 people in the gym. All of these reasons are reasons why Brown Girls happened, but my kids at the time were like the real reason. All of the photos that you saw in the beginning were those kids. All of the ideas that we got were because of those kids. What's cool? What's happening right now? Who do you like? You know, that's who we were putting on social media. So they're super involved. Well, now they're older and have gone off. So our program had always been, we score them to level 7 and then we send them somewhere else because our gym is small and we don't have all the resources. So we send them to bigger gyms. And so those kids now, I think Ray is a level 9, and she's 14 maybe. And she was like a little baby. So yeah, they're all involved even now. And the coaches are still really involved. So Courtney Johnson, well, Dr. Courtney Johnson coached with me at InFlight before she was doctor. And now she's the chairperson of the board with Brown Girls. So it's all kind of, you know, woven in there.
How did the amazing, oh, I'm sorry, Danielle, did you want to?
Yeah. I was wondering what your, or if you have a technique for preparing athletes to manage their mental health as well through the sport. Like, two-part question, that, like, what do you do to help them manage it? And then what do you think is missing from most athletic programs that would help retirees assimilate into non-competitive life after sport?
That's a lot that you just said.
Yeah.
I keep like pulling all these other things into this conversation. I also do circus, and I started circus, like, changed my whole life. I started doing circus 27. I don't want to tell you how long ago that was, though, but it's been a long time. And circus completely changed my life. When I started coaching circus, or doing circus, actually, I guess. So first, I was introduced to contemporary circus through acro, through gymnastics. Someone saw me coaching and was like, "Hey, you'd be great with this program." And so I went into the program just for the acro, because I didn't know anything about contemporary circus and clowns and all that stuff. I was like, I'm not a clown. And as I coached and was invited for another program, so Cirque du Soleil has an outreach program, and that program is social circus. And through social circus, we include word of the week, check-ins, appreciations. So the check-ins, just like literally, how are you doing? And then the appreciations, each kid appreciating the other child, you know, like going in a circle and appreciating. And so I incorporated that into our gymnastics. And so even competitive gymnasts were doing the check-ins and the word of the week and the appreciations. And I definitely feel like, as far as mental health goes, those things helped a lot. On a larger scale, one of my former gymnasts, I've coached a lot of people, is a doctor of psychology. And so I always ask her, bring her in some way, Leela Nelson, to help out in whatever way she feels like is needed. Periodic talks with the girls and that sort of thing. Yeah. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. And if there's anything that you think is missing from the sport or mm-hmm. most athletic programs, that, you know, once you're no longer competitive anymore, it's like, okay, good luck in the world. Like, is
yeah.
something that should be in
a transition.
Yeah,
totally. I don't know what that would look like outside of folks like Tam and Shan, but I do feel like there's a gap. I mean, that's kind of what happened with me and how I started coaching. I went from doing all of these sports and activities to not doing anything at all in college. And I was depressed and didn't even know it. It took a professor to ask me, like, what's going on with you? And when were you happy? And it was like, I was happy when I was doing gymnastics, you know? And so that was like the bridge for me. But some folks don't want to coach. So like, what happens when it's just a complete stop, you know? I do think there's something missing there. But outside of other organizations, I don't know what would help. Do you have ideas? What do you think?
I mean, I got tons of ideas, but this is your podcast.
So. I still want to hear it.
A lot of it, just like, you know, those workshops, those speaking opportunities, more of those topics and conversations at Congress for coaches to yeah. bring back to their kids. Also involvement of parents and teaching parents at, like, you know, whatever weekly or monthly parent meetings about, you know, things to look out for at home. You know, because it's not just the responsibility of the gymnastics coaches, right? But it needs to be a team. And then also setting them up and asking the kids, like, what do you want to do once you're not competing anymore? Or do you want to transition into, like, adult gymnastics competitions, you know, like circus? There are a bunch of different ways, but those conversations need to be held. So,
yeah, I totally agree. And actually, that brings up, so we do these workshops throughout the season. And one of the workshops, so we do three workshops, a judging workshop, just like what to expect from judges, a sports injury workshop, and then beyond gymnastics workshop. So those three, we do a couple of them, like a part one, part two. And Melanie Sinclair leads the beyond gymnastics because she has, like, done everything. She was elite. She did collegiate gymnastics. She went to Cirque du Soleil and performed all over the world. And then she now is back in Orlando coaching and doing personal training. So she, like, the whole gambit of, I mean, outside of, she needs to judge. That'll be the next thing. But, you know, so many careers inside of gymnastics are what you can do to kind of keep that thing happening in your body that you might miss, you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't coach, and I, out of this podcast, I'm doing gymnastics again as an adult.
Oh, but, cool.
Other than this podcast, like I don't have anything where I'm running like different programs for other gymnasts. However, I do think, you know, from this conversation, I think it reminds me of just how important it is to think of gymnastics as a lifelong endeavor. And I think we're getting there, people talking about that and doing that, so that I remember growing up and being in the gym, and I wasn't on the elite track because I wasn't one of those prodigies that they just like took out and like put into a tops team to get into like the elite track as soon as possible. But I remember feeling this pressure around me of to maximize your capability as a gymnast, and because you're basically done in high school. And I was talking to the coach about what the options were to continue in college. I mean, I didn't know. I was like, is there any chance I could do college gymnastics? And she was like, no, not really. And that was like the end of the conversation. There was like nothing else about any other opportunities to continue. But thankfully, I think, and I don't know if social media is part of it, whatever it is, like this generation that we're in, we're so much more aware, and there are so many things happening in our industry, such as like NIL and letting somebody like all of our Olympians, actually, not just all of them can earn money for their future and make the most of the huge momentum of the Olympics, but also still participate in college gymnastics. So I think we're in a really good space for that. But from how you're talking about your organization and Brown Girls Do Gymnastics, it sounds like you are really integrating that by having workshops, including the parents, in much more integral ways than just they're the fundraisers who come and watch the meets and the practices.
Yeah.
But, so I'd love to transition into the big news that came out about Fisk University bringing on a women's artistic gymnastics program. You are an integral part of that. I would love to talk to you and hear more about how that came to be. And you said a few minutes ago that you, when you were applying to colleges, you were only looking at HBCUs, and unfortunately gymnastics wasn't part of it. So was that when the seed kind of got planted in you, even though you hadn't obviously even started your gym when you were 14?
Yeah, I think it was planted when that professor that I was telling you about, who noticed that I was not well. I went to administration and asked them to start a gymnastics team. And it was, I laugh at myself when I say it, because it's like, that's not going to just happen that way. But I didn't think so when I was 18. They said, you can cheer. We have a cheer program. And I think that is what most people who don't know gymnastics, but know that that's an option, that's what they tell you to do to like make up for that gap, you know? And so it was kind of something that I thought about for a while, but forgot about in a certain sense for a very long time, until I had an opportunity to make more noise, you know? When I was I at College Park? I can't remember where I was, but where I was coaching at the time. But the thought, the idea of having a gymnastics team at Clark. So I'm in Atlanta, and there's the Atlanta University Center, which is Clark, Morehouse, Spelman, Morris Brown. Am I forgetting anything? I think those are the schools. Clark has a larger athletic department and a co-ed athletic department. Morehouse is all boys. Spelman lost their athletic, or not lost, but stopped their athletic department. So Clark was the school to look into. And I was just looking for people who were interested in doing gymnastics, and we were going to do like a club team. And we would, instead of calling ourselves Clark, because you can't, if you're not affiliated with the school, really, we would just use their mascot and compete like NAIGC or Even AAU meets, they had started doing a lot of the lady competitions. I think it's ladies division, I think it's what it's called. So I was like the first, I guess my back door into intercollegiate gymnastics. That's what I thought I could do. But people weren't interested. It was really weird, or probably marketing is not my strong suit. So it's probably that I just didn't get the word out enough. And so I was looking back in the Brown Girls Instagram account, and I saw I didn't realize that I posted it in Brown Girls too, about that club team at Clark. But that all started in that particular post was like around 2016. And so that kind of started the whole, hey, look, there's no gymnastics at HBCUs, which is what kind of brought us to Fisk some years later after a lot of other stuff going on.
It's really incredible. And then you recently announced Corinne Wright Tarver will be coming on as the coach, which is incredible. First Black NCAA champion in history. Yeah. How did that happen? Like bringing her on as the coach, or were you part of that process also?
Yeah. So, Fisk, they reached out to us when they first got the idea. It was a board of trustees, member. His name's Frank Simmons. First got the idea from Terica Cromartie, who's a gym mom. And she connected us. We had had conversations before, and she had been supportive of Brown Girls before. And so he had all of the questions. He is an entrepreneur himself. And so he was asking numbers, like stats, how many Black girls are there in gymnastics, and like everything. And when there was the time to name a coach, well, we were kind of, there was a little back and forth, like, when do we announce a coach? And can we get started without a coach? And it was just a lot of back and forth. And then it was like, okay, we need a coach now because we don't know gymnastics. You know, like gymnastics is such a like different sport. It's not football, basketball. And so they felt like they really needed a coach. And they asked, do you have a short list of folks who you think would be a good head coach? Their number one hope was that they could have someone who had collegiate collegiate coaching experience. And so that list was a little short because there aren't a lot of Black and Brown collegiate gymnastics coaches, current or former, you know. But Corinne was at the top of our list. I mean, she's a lawyer, and she was also assistant athletic director. So she like knows the ins and outs of all of this stuff. And actually Umi Salim Beasley, who's at Rutgers, mentioned her, and it was like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, she'd be great. So we added her to the list, and that's who they chose. On paper, like, you couldn't go with anybody else, you know? And then when they actually spoke to her, they were just like, oh my gosh, yes, she's great. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened. Yeah.
And so that's slated to kick off in 2023, right? In the fall, like that will be the first team. So I imagine they're probably recruiting the gymnasts now. I mean, because usually it's like even further back, it'll be like 4 years before that gymnasts will be committing. Wow.
Yeah. We're hoping to see some traction like publicly. I know Corinne's got her eyes on folks. Because she's named, she can definitely talk to people. But I think she's making sure she knows exactly what she wants to do and what she wants to do with her budget and all that good stuff. Fisk is also an NAIA school. So there have been a lot of people who have said like, this is great for NCAA, but they're not NCAA. They're hoping to possibly compete. Well, they can compete NCAA, but they're hoping to have a more broad inclusion in NCAA gymnastics because they're the only NAIA team, not just HBCU. So they're the first NAIA team, first HBCU, first gymnastics team in Tennessee. They're like first everything. And so there's, I know there's just some like intricacies that she's going to have to work out before like full-fledged recruiting. But I know she's got her eyes on people.
Well, that's super exciting.
Yeah.
So I feel a little silly even asking this, like, because everything that you and Brown Girls Do Gymnastics have done is so massive and impactful. And we're going to continue to see that impact in the years to come. And with the team at Fisk, I'm sure that other HBCUs are going to see that. And so there's going to be kind of like this cascade effect, I'm sure. What else is in the works for that brand and for your program? Like, what do you see in the next few years?
I think we have our plate full enough. we'll just like branch out with the things that we're already doing. So we definitely want more HBCUs. We have created the HBCU Gymnastics Alliance, and we are planning to have a roundtable with, we've invited all the HBCUs to come. It will be March 24th at 2 p.m. But so that's one thing. We're hoping to get everybody in and, you know, help however we can help, pull people in wherever, whoever is valuable. And then we have, this is our first year with Camp Isla. Camp Isla is a week-long training camp for gymnasts. So we have our conference that's annual, and it's the girls work out together, but it's not training camp. The Camp Isla is literally training camp. So high performance camp, level 7 to 10 for the girls who are there 5 days a week. And then we have what we're calling training camp, and that's levels 3 to 10, but they do not stay on campus. So I missed that part. The high performance girls actually lodge on HBCU campuses. This year we will be at North Carolina A&T, and we may add Fisk a little later, but we want to make sure the conference is taken care of first. So between the annual conference being held on HBCU campuses and Camp Isla being held on HBCU campuses, and wanting to do more campuses, I think we're good for a little bit. yeah, we'll grow that before we start doing something else, because I'm that girl that will be all over the place.
Being where you are now, if you could go back and speak to either the Darren who was competing or the Darren who was trying to start a gymnastics program at the college you were at, what do you think you would tell her?
I think I would tell myself it's going to be okay. I get really anxious, and I want to see things happen right now. You know, you look at what other people are doing and compare yourself a lot, or I compare myself a lot, and I have to take myself down from that comparison. Nobody grew up like me. Nobody, like even my brothers, you know, nobody sees things the way that I see it. And that goes for everybody in the world. And so just like trust yourself and know that it's gonna be all right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Better Late.
And a little extra special gift for all of our listeners. If you go to trainlikeagymnastapp.com and you download the app, you will get a discount if you use the promo code LISTEN for the annual membership. Now, if you download $1 for the first month and you do monthly, you will also be able to upgrade and use that discount code as well. So I hope to see you on the app. And you can also use that discount code on our website if you want to get merchandise. Have fun.